Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episode, we are making an 11 of the worst signings of the summer window. Then we open up the burn book. While over on the subscription side, we talk about the future of Pep Guardiola's football, and we discuss the best strategy for staying up in the Premier League. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back once again for another double whammy. And I'm joined, as always, by Pete Dorman. How you doing, Pete?
Hello, I'm good, Patrick. Happy to be here. How are things with you?
Good, good. Surviving.
Yeah, it feels like a common theme at the minute. For myself too.
Today's 2 weeks into school.
How has it gone so far?
Mixed bag. It's been okay. Like, she's been pretty good, but like, she has flipped her shit pretty much every day. Like, she doesn't cry about going in. Like, I do look around at the gate and I see like these ugly children like crying and I'm like, couldn't be me. Like, my kid's cute and she's like not pussy. But then she comes home and she does get angry. But she's been really good. And like, now she's starting to make friends. Like, there are a bunch of little kids who've, you know, come up and been like excited to see her and want to play with her. So that feels good. Cause like the first few days she kept coming home and being like, no one wants to play with me. And I was like, oh, Jesus. In the end, I think it was just literally that she only wanted to play the game she wanted to play. And when they didn't want to play that game, she was just like, why is everyone abandoning me? And they were like, because we haven't seen K-pop Demon Hunters. Like, that's why. And you only want to act out K-pop Demon Hunters every day.
It's a real Regina George move.
She is a very Regina George type, not least because she's not that interested in other people, you know, in their feelings or thoughts. Which, like, look, good practice, I say. Majority of people, not worth paying attention to. But maybe not the attitude if you are trying to make friends and you're four.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when I look back at me, say, mid-teens, there was a much greater importance placed on being liked. Not necessarily popular, but being liked by, like, the vast majority of people. Even if you weren't that friendly with them at school, everyone, you would want them to think, oh, yeah, that person's, like, a decent guy.
Yeah.
The older I've got and the more time spent in corporate London, the amount I give a fuck about that now is vanishingly small. I reckon I could count on two hands the amount of people I care or think about me outside of my close friend and family.
But school is a difficult one, right? Because like, school is like, it's kind of your friends and your colleagues at the same time. Whereas when you're at work, you're like, I don't really need to care about these people because I've got a life outside this and friends outside this. When you're a kid, you're like, all I do is spend all day in this fucking place. So I do actually need to be friends with these people. So like, you can employ a little bit of Regina George attitude, but you do also need to make a little bit of an effort. But I think it's going okay. And like, she doesn't seem to object to her uniform. You know, as we've discussed, she's got a Northern Irish teacher who she imitates now. So
it runs in the family.
Next time we see you.
My culture is not your costume, Patrick.
It 100% is my costume.
Apparently, it's your entire family's costume.
Yeah, it's totally our costume. Like, I mean, I feel like the Northern Irish are big into costumes, to be honest. So I think you should brace yourself for that next time you see my child. That she's going to tell you about like the bumblebee, and she's going to tell you about her teacher, Miss Harding. Like, this is kind of how she says it. Like, it's very sweet. But I think you will find it maybe a bit more like a racial attack. To me, it's funny.
But the thing is, if that comes from a four-year-old, I'm like, that's completely excusable. It's a four-year-old. Like, they don't know any better. When it comes from you on the podcast mid-sentence unprompted, it feels like much more a racial attack than anything Coco could ever do, arguably.
But on the other hand, like, no one cares. Like, that's the main thing, you know. Yeah. You're like, there are racisms that you're allowed to do.
Exactly, yeah. Anybody, basically, any white person, racism's fine.
It's like, sometimes.
I can almost see the cogs turning in your head being like,
is this a good route to go down? But I've noticed in recent years that like, a lot of Welsh people are getting like, big into Welsh pride.
Okay.
And like, big into like, kind of, we're Welsh, like, not British. And I think that's fine. Like, if you want to do that, but like, I'm not going to take that seriously.
No.
When a Welsh person does that, I'm a bit like, calm down, you're not Scottish.
Yeah, they spend...
And to be honest, when a Scottish person does it, I'm like, calm
fair
down.
Enough. No, this I'm like, fair like, enough.
I'm like, this isn't real colonialism. It isn't. Like, okay, you go and watch Braveheart, right? And you're like, okay, all the Scots are on one side and Mel Gibson, and all the English are on another side. And then later on, you realize that there were more Scots on the side fighting against William Wallace than there were on William Wallace's side fighting against the English, in inverted commas. And you're just like, yeah. like, I feel like this is maybe not as clean a narrative. Like put it this way. It is not like Indian independence in my book.
No, it's not. I agree with that. But with Scotland, it's easier to agree to it just in the fact that they've always been quite steadfast in their hatred of English people, whereas Welsh people have been like England light for a long, long time, and only now is it becoming an issue.
Scotland feels more, despite the fact that Welsh language is much more common than like Scots Gaelic is in Scotland. Mm. Like Scotland feels much more culturally distinct. Like definitely.
Oh, for sure.
Like with Wales, I'm just like rugby, Tom Jones. With Scotland, I'm just like, oh, there's loads of stuff going on here. Like I can draw you, if you said to me, like draw a caricature of a Scottish person, I'd be like, I've got loads of material. Yeah. You said draw a caricature of a Welsh person, I'd be like,
it would involve a sheep. It would have to involve the sheep. And that would be the defining factor.
I'd be like, I've drawn Tom Jones. Or I've drawn Michael Sheen.
It's either Tom Jones or a leather handbag. You can't really be sure at this point.
Yeah, there's not much to be done there.
But also, so, like Wales is just England where the West Country accent's just got a little bit out of hand. That is basically Wales. And they've seemingly been fine with that for as long as I can remember. Scotland have historically been very, very...
Scotland have not enjoyed it, I would say.
No.
Their interactions with the English.
And I view Great Britain and Northern Ireland as Northern Ireland, Scotland, and then as two separate things, and then England and Wales as a combined entity.
I sort of see it as England and then like Northern Ireland and Scotland, kind of, you know, like obviously not the same thing, but like aligned.
Yeah, they're more aligned but separate entities, and then
I forget about Wales.
Even like the Welsh devolved state has the least power of all three.
Sure.
You know, it's basically a parent-teachers conference at this point.
That actually sums up exactly how I feel about Wales. When people talk about Wales, I'm like, this is the PTA. Like that's what it sounds like, where they're just like, I'm in the Welsh Parliament. And I'm like, you might as well say to me, I'm in the PTA.
Yeah.
Like, that's how much I care about that. Like, look, if you are Welsh, I'm not really going after you, but my point is only that like, there are obviously racisms which are like basically fine and are clearly funny.
Yeah.
You know, like I saw a Scottish person the other day saying that like England is literally the worst nation on the surface of the earth. And I was just like, this is the kind of racism that everyone should be able to get behind. And it's actually quite hard to disagree with. The only way you could disagree with it is that you're like, there's always America.
Yeah.
And also I would argue that probably if you started ranking, then you'd probably be like England and America at the bottom, but maybe only just above them come nations like Scotland. Like it's not like like I think in Scotland's mind they were just like, we're like right at the top with the cool nations, like fucking, you know, New Zealand and Brazil.
I think Scotland are pretty well. I think people have a real romantic view about Scotland. There's the Highlands, there's the accent. I think when you meet, having lived
there... Yeah, but it's not about the romance of the culture, because I think there's a lot of romance to America, except that it's full of fucking Americans, you know? Australia as well, you're like, Australia, like, culturally, rock bottom.
Yeah.
Australians as people, though, very likable.
Take them to a coffee shop and see how much you like them when you leave.
Oh, God, that's a really good point. But on the other hand, go to a coffee shop.
We've gone so hard down the fucking white racism angle.
You know, but white racism, this is what I'm saying. Like, white racism, everybody likes it. Everyone agrees that it's funny. Like, if you want a good coffee, though, in London, then it's like you can put your ear to the ground, you know, and listen to the, like, plodding footsteps of the Australian. You know, the R.M. Williams boots. And before long, an Australian will appear and they will simply lead you like a will-o'-the-wisp to the nearest drinkable coffee.
It's fucking insufferable, though. So, like, it goes way too far. I was in Sheffield a couple of weeks ago visiting my family, and there was a New Zealand-owned coffee shop brand or whatever that we went to.
which feels like bougie when you're like, ooh, I've got like the Charmeleon of Wait. Australians.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the shiny alternative card.
Yeah, the evolved shiny. Yeah.
But like they had like a full on menu that half it was just coffees. Again, over the top.
All right.
I want a black coffee, please. Specifically, a long black and Americano's fine. If
I still don't really know what a cortado is. I'm just like, sure that.
But on it, they had something, I can't even remember what it was called, but it was something like 60/40 pour over or something. And then in brackets it said, please allow 10 to 15 minutes for this to be made. Like it was a fucking souffle.
Yeah, like when you order a souffle. I was going to say.
Or like a paella or something. It's like, please allow 20 minutes for this to be cooked because the process is... And I was like, this is a fucking coffee. And it was like £9.
Shouldn't you get on board with that though, given that that is kind of like the Guinness of coffees?
No,
that they're
okay,
just like,
so
we're going to do it right.
No.
It's going to take 10 minutes. And at the end of it, most people are not going to understand why you care.
But the difference, the fundamental difference here is that one, the Guinness folklore is largely facetious. And
no, it isn't.
It is largely facetious.
They've literally just made a TV show about it. You fucking you on about?
No. But that I've not.
That
seen...
looks like the world's biggest piece of shit.
I don't think that is indicative of Guinness culture. Because that is literally just going to be like Peaky Blinders, but with Guinness.
Yeah,
and it's going to be shit. And I really don't think the Guinness family were like the Shelbys, if I'm honest. I think this is largely dramatized, but with Guinness, people who like good Guinness, they're unlikely to not go to a pub because it doesn't have great Guinness. They're not going to be like, oh, we can't go here because this has terrible Guinness. They're probably still going to have Guinness and be like, this isn't a nice Guinness, but it's fine. Unless it's like terribly, terribly bad. I think people who like coffee are way, way more stuck up and way more snobby. And also, the more eccentric and good that coffee is, quote unquote good, the more expensive it is. That pour over coffee that took 15 minutes was like £8-9 for a coffee. The better a Guinness is, at least in my mind, the better a Guinness is, the more traditional the pub it is and the cheaper it is. Like a really good Guinness in a traditional pub is like £5. And then you go to get your shit ones in like Cornerbridge Street in the middle of London and they're like £7. I think those are the fundamental differences between coffee wankiness and Guinness wankiness.
Yeah. I mean, I also think it's more legit to be a wanker about Guinness because I'm like, the only point to drinking Guinness is that it is a pleasurable experience. Whereas sometimes you just drink a coffee because you need a fucking coffee in you, right?
True.
Like as in coffee is sometimes a pleasure and sometimes it's caffeine delivery system or, you know, something warm to drink because it's cold. And like often it's a combination of the two. But
sure,
there's almost always a slightly functional element to a coffee. Whereas there's never a functional element to a Guinness. It's only there to make life better. And so if you're a wanker about Guinness, then I think, well, like, of course, because it's kind of like if you know, if you go to somebody's house and they were like, do you want a biscuit? And you looked at the biscuits and you were like, these are all shit biscuits. You'd think, well, why eat one? If none of them's like actually going to give me pleasure, what's the point? The same, I think, applies to like something that you're drinking that is not water, basically.
Mm.
Look, some people will say,
That we've wasted
a lot of time on this.
Because
I'm looking at the timer on my recording device and we're
at
14
minutes. we've only got
a build an 11 today, so it's like not going to take long.
We're usually 10 minutes into the football section at this stage.
Nah, okay, right, let's do it. Okay, so we've got a question this week from Tryggvi Gudmundsson. Sorry, can't do Icelandic names. I tried to learn from an Icelandic guy in Japan and I found it complicated. Pete's pouring a Guinness Nitro Surge as we speak. He says, could you make your 11 of signings that you hate this summer? Alternatively, you could do signings you like, but maybe that's less fun. Indeed it is. So Pete and I decided to take the negative angle on this. But while I think Tryggvi wanted us to do... an 11 each. We've decided to combine it because otherwise we'll be here all night. So the way we're going to run it is like a draft. So basically, we will take it in turns to pick a position and pick a player for that position. And then that slot is gone. So we are truly building a combined 11 here. And I guess to some degree, there's competition because you might, you know, take a position where I had somebody I really wanted to get in. But do we just want to pick who goes first? Do we want to toss a coin? I mean...
Do we first want to decide a formation, or are we going that granular?
I've gone for a pretty straight up 4-3-3.
Okay, I've gone 4-2-3-1.
That's fine.
But I can reformat it as well.
I can fit into a 4-2-3-1. That's really not a problem. But if you could call it a 4-3-3, maybe that is a bit easier.
Yeah, I mean, I think based on where we end up in terms of what picks get like locked out early, both a 4-2-3-1 and a 4-3-3 can be the other one, basically. Most of mine can swap into like a 4-3-3. Fine.
Okay. I'm going to flip a coin online. you call it.
We've gone full Black Mirror.
You call it.
You've had to go online to flip a coin as opposed to flipping a tangible real coin in real life.
My wallet's downstairs.
What in the chat GPT?
I literally search coin flip online and you get a thing just like straight up on Google. Anyway, fucking pick.
Head.
It's tails. So I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Okay. I might go really, really punchy straight out the gate. Center forward.
Okay.
Though, to be honest, basically all my forwards are center forwards-ish. But, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I'm going Viktor Gyökeres.
I considered it.
Here's the thing. Is he good? Okay. Okay. Lots and lots of caveats to this. He's got 3 goals so far. 2 goals and a penalty. He's got 2 goals so far.
Sure.
And actually, I thought the Champions League game against Athletic Club was interesting. Because in that game, he was suddenly playing like Viktor Gyökeres, right? Like, I don't know who watched it, because if you're not an Arsenal or a Bilbao fan, I don't know why you would watch it. It's 2 very defensive teams, like, having a horrible game. But in that match, he was picking the ball up wide, running in behind, taking on fullbacks. Like, it was actually really interesting to see him do that. And it's possible we will see more of that when Havertz comes back. We might see Gyökeres start games where he's the centre forward and Havertz is in midfield, but in reality it ends up swapping a bit. Or we might see games where Gyökeres even just starts on the left. You know, like that could totally happen too, if you kind of want to do like a concealed 2 striker formation. I would also say that, like, he's getting to know the team. The team is trying to change its style pretty significantly. I talked about this on Monday on the transfer flow, but people have been talking about Arsenal's deep build-up this season. But Arsenal are doing this very deep build-up in an attempt to then do transitions, like what's called an artificial transition, right, in football, which is either when you win the ball back and you very quickly, like, counter, essentially, but it's not a full transition from, like, your box to the opposition box. Or when you are playing with the ball very, very slowly and then suddenly you go forward quickly. Like, these are sometimes called artificial transitions. Arsenal are trying to do this more. Last season, Arsenal would actually move the ball up the field quickly. Like, okay, not quickly relative to like the whole league, but relative to a lot of big teams. They would often get the ball up the wings really high quite fast and then play a lot of lateral passes. This season, they're clearly trying to bide their time, draw in the press, and then go forward fast. So that's a work in progress. There's also been a bunch of games recently where there literally hasn't been an attacking midfielder. Like, Ødegaard got injured, came back, got injured again. Like, Eze is clearly not totally trusted to know the system enough yet to just start games. But he looked, you know, he looks good. And I think, you know, the fact that he got minutes as an actual attacking midfielder in the second half of the City game is promising. So look, there are all these caveats here. But Gyökeres has had 3 games already where he's had 0 shots. 3 games. And Scott Willis, who's an Arsenal analyst on Twitter, said that in, I think, 86 games that Kai Havertz has played for the club, he's had 8 games where he's had 0 shots and played at least 50 minutes.
That's kind of crazy.
So like 1 in 10.
Yeah.
And also, you know, like, bear in mind that Havertz has also played like some midfield minutes, like played in some weird positions.
And also, like, Havertz isn't that like, for if Havertz isn't like a shot happy type guy. If he's playing up there, he's linking playing off players.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas Gyökeres, like, is meant to be getting shots.
Yeah.
Now, look, Arsenal have had some pretty tough fixtures so far. Like Liverpool away, Man City. Like, I don't really expect a striker to be like, it would be great if they did, but I wouldn't expect a striker to be getting loads of shots in those games, to be honest with you. Like, in the Liverpool game, a lot was made of the fact Gyökeres didn't have a shot. Ekitike didn't have a shot either. Yeah. And I think Ekitike looks pretty good. Gyökeres also had like 5 box touches against City. And in the long run, getting a lot of box touches does tend to mean that you start to get your shots. You know, like, you're getting the ball in the box. He's also had some games, like the Forest game, where there were really nice moments of link up. And I was like, oh, okay. Because actually, of course, the thing is at Sporting, he wasn't just a guy in the box who got shots. He was dropping deep and running at people and linking play. And if Arsenal want to turn him into the guy in the box who just gets shots, then they can maybe do that, but you are kind of chopping off a bit of the player that you signed. You know, like that's quite a perverse thing to do. But 0 shots in 3 games so far, so many bad touches, which end moves. Arsenal trying to adapt to him while also being in win now mode is hardly ideal. And when I look at him, I just kind of think sometimes you paid like 60 mil plus for this guy. Even if you thought that was like the safest option of the bunch in front of you, I wonder if there was another option. Like I look at someone like Semenyo and I think, could you have got Semenyo and played him at centre forward for 60 mil? Like probably.
Yeah.
And he's pretty good in the air. He's pretty two footed. And now I kind of think, I wonder if the path to like a better attack, like for one, I'm just like, this Arsenal attack probably just looks better with Kai Havertz playing centre forward right now. Because actually the times that he was on the field last season with a fit attack around him, Arsenal's attack looked pretty fucking good. Like I think about the Sporting game when they'd just beaten City 4-1 and Arsenal went and slapped them 5-1 away from home. And it was like, it was pretty devastating. But I also wonder like Martinelli at centre forward, which I think is an interesting option. I even think if Madueke is going to continue playing the way he's played, I mean, obviously he's out for a bit now, but if he explodes the way it looks like he could, you want to get him and Saka in the team. And so maybe then you try and do like a PSG type thing. You like try Saka at centre forward in some games where like you can then have a really fluid interchanging attack. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I just look at your careers and I'm extremely unconvinced. I'm a bit concerned. I mean, it's not really that different from what I expected, but I just think like for 60 mil, you do kind of want a guy who's going to be at least a pretty good striker. And my concern is that Arsenal might not even have that. Like, I think he'll get some goals and I could be totally wrong here. He might adapt and everything's fine. But right now, I think the early returns are quite, quite bad.
Yeah, I considered him, but I think just because he's so fresh in the Premier League, I didn't want to make too harsh or too quick a judgment.
Oh, I haven't worried about that at all.
Yeah. Oh, for your entire team?
Yeah, for my entire team. Yeah. Who have you got then? Right, your turn to pick a position.
Okay, so I'm going to go right wing.
I went very long on that one, by the way. I'm not going to go that long on all right. My players.
I'm going to go right wing.
Okay, of course.
Slam dunk, Anthony Elanga.
Anthony Elanga.
This is just a terrible, terrible signing. Big money for a guy who isn't goodness a needle gracious mover at all. He went for 55 mil. And when you look at some of the other players who aren't necessarily like-for-like players, but like attacking players that went in the same window for similar fees, Madueke was around that fee, 52 mil or something. Xavi Simons, 52 mil as well, I think. Eze was a little bit higher, like 60, raising the mid-60s with add-ons. These aren't direct like-for-like alternatives to Elanga, but if you were to take either one of those and drop them in to Newcastle's kind of forward line, they would move the needle far more than Elanga ever could. And Madueke's the same age and Simons is younger. So it's not like he's... I just don't understand why Newcastle went out and spent so much money so early in the window on a guy who has kind of only ever shown to be like average at best in the Premier League. And they obviously had the money too. Like they had money to spend because they were in for Ekitike and Sesko and all of that and nothing happened. But yeah, I just don't think his ceiling's overly high, not 55 million points high. He had a good season at Forest last year, 17 non-penalty goal involvements, maybe 14 the season before that. But big overperformance last year, 10 expected goal involvements, so he was plus 7. And he sat at like 0.36 non-penalty expected goals all season last season per 90. Nothing special, especially not for like the preeminent figure in, or one of the preeminent figures in a team that finished in a European spot. Granted, it was like in the end, because it was so, everything was so congested, 4-3-7. It was, they ended up, what, conference playoffs or something? But like for one of the preeminent attacking figures in a team finishing 7th and could have feasibly finished 4th if results in the last day went their way, setting a 0.36 non-penalty expected goals per 90 across that season is pretty underwhelming as underlying numbers, even if he did get 17 goal involvements across that season. And the only thing that pops, right, if you go on FBref and look at his like scouting report graphs, only thing that pops in his underlying numbers last season are set-piece deliveries. Shot creating actions from dead balls, corners taken, crosses per 90. That is all team effects from Nottingham Forest being massive and playing, like leaning in really hard into set-piece execution. And granted, he needs to deliver those. But I think that's a pretty low ask for a top-level Premier League footballer to deliver a dead ball to where you want it if you're like a dead ball specialist team. And Forest were like an absolutely elite dead ball specialist team last year. Outside of that, like, he was bottom 15% for overall live ball passes, bottom 30% for shot creating actions from live balls, completed under one dribble with a 30% success rate. He scraped top quarter for things like progressive passes received and carries in the penalty area, which are good positive indicators, but those are the best metrics that he has in open play. Top quarter, like scraping into the top quartile. Everything else is just underwhelming or straight up bad. And he's like 55 million quid. He's 23, so yeah, sure, he could improve a bit. But like, when you're 23, you're kind of the player that you will be at 26, but the player you'll be at 26 will just be a more refined version of what you are at 23. The player you are at 19 could be quite different to the player you end up at 24. I feel by the time you get to 23 and with the amount of experience that Elanga's had in the Premier League, this is the type of player he is. And he's not a huge needle mover, but they've paid 55 million quid for him. And he's not a nailed on starter either. Like, I think if a team like Newcastle, and like Newcastle are a big team, but they're not massive in the sense of like financial, like obviously they have the by far the richest owner, but they are tied to their revenue. They're tied to a load of things to keep, you know, FFP on, like, on the right side of FFP basically. So these signings can really, really hurt a team like Newcastle and their aspirations to become nailed on, like, minimum Europa League finishers every season. And Elanga started 3 of the 6 games in the Premier League and Champions League so far. He's usually getting subbed on for Jacob Murphy. Outside of that, would the likes of Madueke or Eze or Xavi Simons start in that team if they were purchased for a similar amount that the Newcastle purchased Elanga for? In my opinion, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Definitely. And I think that's the main difference here in that Elanga. One isn't just, he's not a terrible player. I just don't think he's overly special. He's not a needle mover, especially not for a team that has the aspirations of Newcastle. But also, the players that went later in the window as well, they went super early for Elanga as well. It was early July.
Yeah, like that was the first of those moves.
Yeah, so all of those players who went after him for in and around the same money, Madueke is the same age, Simons is a year younger. I'm not saying those are necessarily perfect profiles for what Newcastle were trying to build, but the fact that those players are so much better and so move the needle so much more for any team they're dropped into than Elanga has ever shown he can do, or has done, or potentially can do with a much lower ceiling, I just hate the move.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's like a bad player, you know, like, I think he's actually like a pretty good player, and I think he's useful. It's just that I don't think he changes much for them.
No.
Like, he's essentially, Murphy's old, so we need a young Murphy. So they went and got that guy. And like, okay, that's good in a sense. Like, it means you can carry on doing this thing that you like to do. And like, in the Champions League, you can see, against Barcelona, I was like, man, you are just the fastest guy on the pitch, man. Like, sure. He does just blaze past people. But Eddie Howe was saying recently, like, he literally said, I think yesterday, you know, the squad's missing a bit of magic right now. And I was like, that's exactly what I said when I wrote the fucking transfer flow preview. I was like, they need final balls. They need one guy who, facing a deep or mid block,
yeah,
has that little bit of magic.
Just unlock it.
And they just didn't go and sign that guy at all. And they went and signed like a run fast winger. And like, that's, again, it's not the worst thing to have, but it's also not like I would pay £55 million to have that.
No.
Especially when you do still have Murphy. So yeah, don't love it. You know, I think I am a bit more positive about this than I was before, but like, it's hard to look at the moves when you look at the other moves.
It's the money is the main kicker for me, basically.
It's hard to look at the moves and not feel that this is a bit of a waste of resources. Okay, where am I going next? I said I was going to be quick with some of these. Centre mid.
Okay.
Thomas Partey.
Sure.
A literal piece of shit rapist.
Mm-hmm.
Villarreal, like, okay, like, look, obviously you should never ever sign a rapist. Like, that is a rule. They're actually surprisingly difficult for football clubs, it turns out. But, like, Villarreal are such a feel-good club. They're a smart club. Like, they had a really good season last year playing great attacking football. The fans were really excited about them. And they went out this summer and they signed Thomas Partey and Manor Solomon, who is a, like, genocide, like, supporting fucking IDF glazing piece of shit also. And like, there's been protests about it, like, from the whole club, and rightly so, because like, it's a disgrace. Like, I don't think clubs seem to realize that, like, it makes it very hard to support your team when there's a literal monster on the pitch. Fuck Thomas Partey, shouldn't be playing football, should be in prison. Like, he literally played the other night against Spurs with Villarreal. Do you know what he did the next morning when his teammates were, like, convalescing at the hotel getting ready to head back to Spain? He went to Southwark Crown Court to plead not guilty. That's what he did.
Mm.
Fuck this guy. Like, I just never want to see his fucking stupid face again. He's also shit. He's shit and old now. Fuck him. Anyway, so I just think, like, I realize that it's not quite the same thing as saying, like, I don't like this signing. I think this is a suboptimal use of resources. But, sure. Like, objectively, this is, like, the worst move of the summer.
Yeah. On just moral grounds alone, it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's gross. Okay. Like, what have you got?
Okay. Who am I going for next? Okay, I'm going to go to left wing.
Ooh. This is wow, really filling up the attack,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Well, I think it...
Like, I should have done this because I've got, like, nothing in defense.
In terms of bad moves, I think they are quite top heavy. This summer is quite top heavy for questionable moves in the market. But I've got... This is a loan move, so this is a little bit of a technicality. I've gone for Jadon Sancho to Aston Villa.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So that's a loan. Is it... Is there an option or is there... There's not an obligation, I don't think.
I actually don't know. Let me see.
I gather that Berichieza has scored his first Arsenal goal.
Oh, okay.
Against Port Vale. Did I tell you that I bought an Arsenal kit with Berichieza?
You didn't tell me, but I saw... You had the white one with Eze on the back.
Yeah, it's a really good kit. And then Emma was just like, oh, so you're going to wear this casually? And I was like, fuck no. Like, it's just like, I'm going to wear this to run in. I'm going to wear this to work out in. It's made of polyester.
Yeah, it's a literal sports shirt.
Yeah, I was like it's a fun... It is way too big, though. Like, they basically tell you, they're like, oh, this is this runs really small, so get, like, a really big one. So I got really big one, but it is actually really big. I was like, I should have just got like...
And the normal size.
Yeah. A regular size. But I might like...
Is it the replica one or the authentic one? Because the authentic ones are tiny.
Fuck the authentic ones, yeah. It's the replica one, definitely. But it's... I think I'm going to take it to the tailor and get him to crop it a little bit. Because like... Because the width of it is like... It's very big, but I like that to run in, right? Like, you don't want to feel, like, constricted when you run. But the length of it, I'm just like, this is too long. And so the other day, I was like, I can't tuck this in when I go running. Look like fucking Rodri going for a run. Like, so I'm going to take it to the tailor and be like, I need you to alter the sleeve of this blazer that I just ordered from South Korea.
Yeah.
And also... Here is a football kit that I would like you to adjust so that I look better when I go running in it. Fucking stupid. But
you could get them to crop it like they're doing with, like, you know, the Brute Archives t-shirts.
Yeah, that's what
right,
I'm doing.
Like right at the hip line. Just a little bit, like a little bit spicy cropped. A little bit too short.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, what, like a slutty
yeah,
boy
yeah.
thing.
Just like, soft, like soft slut. Soft slut.
McConaughey in a Magic Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we got so off real.
Oh, you know that scene? You know that scene in Scary Movie,
which
where he's wearing a yellow t-shirt and he's just like, "Does this t-shirt make me look gay?" And the guy's like, "No." And he grabs the bottom of it and puts it up inside and then through the collar, so it like ties a knot. And he goes, "What about now?" It's like that. That's how I'm wearing that shirt.
Yeah. Okay. So from what I quickly deduced there, no loan option. Or obligation.
Okay.
But they are... So one of my main issues with it, other than him just not being a very like proven Premier League player, they're paying 80% of his salary. So Jadon Sancho, famously underwhelming Premier League player so far, has...
Is this like 300k?
There's only 11 players in Premier League, according to Capology, who earn more than Jadon Sancho does.
So let me just work that out. So 250 at 80% is like 200k.
Yeah. So Aston Villa are paying £200,000 a week for Jadon Sancho. Only 11 players in the Premier League earn more than Jadon Sancho currently. And this is kind of similar to what Villa did with like Rashford and Asensio. And to be fair, they were more successful than my like initial like pessimism, skepticism had thought they would be.
Sure.
But Rashford was I think Rashford was maybe a little bit more expensive, like 220, maybe up to £250,000 a week. But the one thing with Rashford was that he has previously been good at points in the Premier League. He has
and it
had
was half a season
good
where
seasons.
They were in the knockouts of the Champions League. Like they had something to play for.
But Rashford has proven that he has the ability, the physicality, the skill set to thrive and to be successful in the Premier League. He's done it before. Jadon Sancho has never done it. Jadon Sancho has never done anything spectacular on the football pitch outside of Germany. And this is like the criticisms of Sancho are that he's just not able to, he's just not physical enough to do it in the Premier League. He's not super fast. He's not super strong. He's not super physical. He's not super dribbly, especially not in tight spaces or against set defences. Like he's okay at a lot of that, but he's not elite at any of it. And that just doesn't fly in the Premier League. Like, if he doesn't have one attribute, at least, that he's, like, lights out at, if he's not, like, lights out quick, that he doesn't need super technical skills, he just needs a bit of quick feet out and round, that can fly in the Premier League. If he's, like, really, really hard to dispossess, if he's really, really tricky in tight spaces, so that people are terrified to come near him and bring him down, all of those things, you need one of those attributes to be, like, top, top level to be successful in the Premier League as a wide forward. So Jadon Sancho is reasonably good at most of them, but not special at anything. And it just doesn't translate well to successful life in the Premier League.
Ted has been making this argument that he should play in midfield. He was just like, if you had him in a three-man midfield with two guys who are defensively stable, like then the fact that he doesn't have top-end pace doesn't matter as much. He is still like good at dribbling, just like not fast, right? As in like, you could have it, like if you had him in a sort of Ryan Cherki role, where he can just basically wriggle through small spaces and use his creative passing. He was like, that I think might be, it wasn't necessarily saying like that would bang, but it was just like, that might be the best way to maximize his strengths and minimize his weaknesses.
It is interesting.
And I think they could try that.
It is interesting because if you look at like his comparative numbers from Bundesliga, his 5 seasons in the Bundesliga, his 5 seasons in the Premier League, like the things that are kind of stable or have been pretty stable are his progressive passes, his progressive carries, and his progressive receptions, which would kind of work in a midfield linking role. Things that have gone off, things that have dropped significantly are his non-penalty expected goal involvement, his key passes, his shots, dribbles completed as well. Like all of those things have gone way down from the Bundesliga to the Premier League. But he is still reasonably stable in terms of like progressive passing and carrying to what he was in the Bundesliga. Those are the one thing that have kind of remained, but again, still not elite in any way. And yeah, I just don't see why they've done this, because they're not going to play him in the field. There's no chance. They're going to play him on the left. They're going to basically replace Rashford with him, and he's just not going to be able to do it as well, because he's never been able to do it as well, because he doesn't have enough potency in the skill set that he has.
He's got no elite physical attribute, right? Like not, he's not especially strong or big.
He
or
just
fast,
doesn't have
like,
enough
have
of something to make it in the Premier League, to be like complete, to be impactful in games in the Premier League. We've seen that across all of his time in the Premier League so far. And it's no wonder when he goes out to Dortmund on loan and it's like, oh, okay, he's good again. It was Manchester United with a problem. Manchester United are a problem, but they're not the problem. His physicality is the problem, or his lack thereof. And when you have the space in a much more transitional league, when you're coming up against defenders that just generally give you more space, or just aren't as big or as fast or faster than you, you can find a lot of success. Also, when you're coming up against like 60% of the league that is genuinely bad, that helps as well. That doesn't happen in the Premier League. I think there's going to be a lot of money that they're going to outlay, like £8 million from today until the end of the season. They're going to pay him £8 million quid, basically. And that's not including what they paid him already, just for him to play there. I just don't. With Rashford, at least I could see that he has done it before in the Premier League, so I get why. I see a roadmap to him being impactful.
Sure,
I don't
see
a roadmap to Jadon Sancho being overly impactful.
I think if this had been a different manager, then I could have maybe seen it. I think there is a route maybe to Sancho being useful in the Premier League, but I do not think that route happens under Unai Emery. Like I think it needs to be with a manager who is content to do something a bit unusual with him. So like, for example, if he was under Thomas Frank, I could totally see that, you know, where it was like, okay, we're going to make you a bespoke role where you're kind of a midfielder, kind of a winger, kind of an attacker, but really like, it doesn't matter. You just do like the same shit.
Yeah. It's kind of weird to do that for a lone player, though.
Well, sure, but this is, but he's young enough that you could be like, this is not just a loan, right? This, I mean, is 25. A loan to buy. No, yeah, exactly. Like. But that means that you could, like, if you like it, if it works, sure, then you can make it permanent, have him there permanent. So there was a rumor, I mean, that he was maybe going to go to Roma and play under Gasperini. And I was like, I was quite disappointed that he didn't do everything in his power to make that happen. Because I do understand, like, look, you know, if you've got a contract, get paid. And maybe he wants to stay in the UK now. But honestly, like, from a footballing perspective, Gasperini is just about the best coach he could play for. Like, he's obviously got a history of rehabilitating people, but he does have these weird attacking roles.
But I also think, like
Charles de Ketelaere and Lookman, it's like, are those guys wingers or are they attacking midfielders? Well, they're a bit of both. And I think
the league helps there as well.
I agree. But, like, if you had a Gasperini type, like, if you still had De Zerbi in the Premier League, Sancho could be good for him. But you don't, so you can't.
I think Sancho can be good in the Bundesliga, in Liga and in Serie A.
Even if he was at City, though. Like, I look at City, like, I wouldn't want to have him there. But, like, you look at the way that Bernardo Silva plays now. Bernardo Silva can't really do anything now. But he's, like, safe on the ball. He's got a little bit of creativity. He's quite hard to get off the ball. Like, Sancho could probably do that. Like, if you had him in the squad, I don't think he would be useless. But, yeah, I agree. I think there was a narrow path for Sancho to be a useful Premier League contributor. And I think that at Aston Villa, under Unai Emery, that path is basically, like, nil. So, where should we go next? Let's go in the back line. Not because I want to, but just to get it out of the way. I'm going to go for Jackson Chachua, who is a fullback who joined Wolves this summer. So Wolves went and got two fullbacks. They got Wolfe from RZ Alkmaar, and they got Chachua, who was from Genoa. Have I just gone mad? No, he was from Genoa. Why have I gone insane? I think it's because I've been looking at quite a few other Serie A signings.
Verona.
That's the one. Who came from Genoa? Yeah, anyway. Verona. So he came into a team that should have conceived of themselves as relegation possibles, right? Like, everybody knows everybody knows that Wolves could get relegated this season. Like, that is a serious worry. And they lost Ryan Aitnouri and they lost Cunha. And I think in attack, they actually made some really good moves. So they brought in Arokodare to play alongside Larsson. They've also got Fer Lopez, who doesn't have a big, like, track record, but is extremely young and, like, looks really good in the numbers that we've seen. And then in defense, they went and got these two fullbacks. One, Wolfe, is a guy who looked quite bad defensively in the Eredivisie, which concerns me. And then Chachua, who's coming in from Serie A and who doesn't seem to be particularly good at anything. Like, he's got a very low pass accuracy, but he's not playing particularly valuable or hard passes. He's not very active defensively or very successful when he does do defensive things. He's middling in the air. He's 24. So on the plus side, like, maybe he can improve. But on the other hand, Wolves are in a relegation battle now. Wolves have got zero points after five games of the season. Relegation is not only a serious possibility, but now is, like, worryingly plausible, because there are all sorts of other teams in the Premier League who are in the relegation battle, but some of those have got points on the board, you know? So this is the thing, like we talk about West Ham, but West Ham, points on the board. Sunderland, points on the board. What have Wolves got? They've got nothing. And this is a real serious worry. Like, you can't afford to have a long adaptation period for fullbacks when you're in a relegation battle. You can afford to blood wingers.
Yeah.
You know, you can afford to blood attacking midfielders, even strikers. But your central midfielders and your defenders, in my opinion, need to be fairly solid. And already, West Ham are 3 points and one goal difference behind West Ham. Already, they are 8 points and 11 goal difference behind Sunderland.
7 point lead as well.
To me, that's gone.
Yeah.
Can you make up 11 points when you're in a relegation battle? I don't think you can. Like, I think they've got to basically say now, okay, our hope is we finish above West Ham, Leeds, and I guess Villa are technically in this conversation, which is kind of hilarious. And yeah. Burnley, like that's their hope now. Because you look at Sunderland and you're like, 8 points, man. Like, that is a fucking lot. Like, yeah, I think that really is.
Yeah, Burnley is that one that they're like, we need to finish above Burnley.
But they need to finish above, like, three of these teams.
Oh, sure.
And right now they've got this points disadvantage. You're like, okay, Villa, yeah. You're like, West Ham are catchable, Burnley are catchable, but it's still 4 points that you've got to get. And, like,
you that, imagine Villa will be fine in the end overall. Yeah,
you imagine
this
is
really, really. I mean,
Villa look shocking. Villa are playing relegation level football, but Villa also have enough talent in the squad.
Way better squad. Yeah,
and Villa are above them.
Yeah.
Villa are above them. Like, that's the thing. So I just look at them and I'm like, they spent 12.5 million euros on Chachua this summer. Sunderland got Nordi Mukiele for the same fee.
Mm.
They also got Hetrauda in on loan. So they went and signed a defender from PSG and a defender from RB Leipzig, but in fairness, not just guys who I think, you know, they're defenders who want to defend with the ball, you know, who want to pass it around. Like, those are guys who can actually defend. Like, those are good defenders. Sunderland went and got those guys, and Wolves went and took gambles on two people who don't even have good numbers.
Yeah.
That is so worrying to me. I just don't understand it at all. So I just think it's a really, really cavalier move. And when I look at it, I think, were they just really certain this was a banging move? Or did they have, you know, some agent type reason to go for this move? Or did they get their analysis of the state of the league wrong this year and think that we're just going to stay up over these three promoted teams? Because if it's the latter, I think they're in for a serious surprise. I think they're in for a really nasty surprise. They're going to be in a relegation battle this season.
Yeah.
And come mid-season, if these fullbacks, even if just one of them proves to be as bad as I think they look in the numbers, I think they're seriously up shit creek.
Yeah. They've been trending this way for like four seasons in a row, year on year getting worse, and nothing's been done about it. I think this is just general ignorance. That is...
Yeah, but then you do look at these other moves and you're like, this is good. Like, this is good. Like, they could have gone and got, like I say again, Mukiele, 12 mil to Sunderland.
No, I'm not saying there isn't moves out there they could have done. There absolutely is. I'm saying that they're existing in this kind of ignorant state where they're like, I think we'll be fine, even though we've trended downwards consistently.
Yeah, but at the same time, my point with Mukiele is only that they clearly wanted to get a right back. And when they looked around, they were like, what about this fucking guy? Like, this random guy from Verona. If they were looking around, then there were options out there. And so I just, to me, it's just baffling on so many levels. Like, I think they could have done so many other things. I think it would have even been better, like, not to sign this guy. Like, seriously, just to keep that money. But it's galling, because when I look at their attack, I think Arokodare, Tolu Arokodare and Strand Larsen, is actually a fucking good, like, mid-table, like, strike partnership. Both those guys, I think, are great. Fer Lopez, like I say, is an interesting gamble, right? But it's just strange to me, and I think they might just get relegated, man.
Like, I mean, we both tipped them for relegation in the relegation episode, whenever that was, 2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago.
And then after we had that conversation, I was like, I wish I'd gone harder on West Ham. But I'm glad that in the end I said Sunderland to stay up there, because I didn't say it on the transfer flow. I chickened out.
Did he?
And then here I was just like, I said that I thought Sunderland are an interesting shout to stay up, and Sunderland have looked good, man.
Yeah.
Like, so anyway, like, Chachua, let's move on, because we've got a bunch of these guys.
Yeah. Staying in defence, I'm going to go for a centre back.
Mm-hmm.
Jarel Kwanzaa to Leverkusen.
Wow, that's hard.
Do you think that's harsh? Because.
Think it's a lot of money for the Bundesliga.
It's a lot of money.
But I do think he's an excellent player.
I don't rate him.
Wow.
And this is their club record signing. £35 million all in. He's 22, so he is young. And that's, and you know, he's going to the Bundesliga from experience in Premier League. That should serve him well. But he was just never good enough to make it Liverpool. And that's not necessarily a stick to beat him with, given that Liverpool's squad over the past like 6 years has been one of the greatest squads assembled, or at least in part, in Premier League era. So not being good enough to make it into Liverpool's team in that era doesn't necessarily mean you're not a good player. But if you're going to make it in at one point, or if you're going to play at least a good amount of minutes at one position, it's probably going to be centre-back, because they have been thin there for a while. And I think it's quite telling that even now that they're super thin, obviously they thought they were going to get in Gehi. That didn't happen. Being so thin at centre-back as a squad and still being willing to let him go without having a succession. Like, you know the way like the Gehi move fell through because Igor deal to Palace fell through and all of that. Like, they didn't safeguard him enough. They didn't value him enough to like put safeguardings around this transfer.
But don't you think that the move was really just like, it's what they needed to do to get Wirtz done? And so they were like, we'll do what it takes.
Sure, as in, like, keep the balance sheet palatable.
Or just to get Leverkusen to agree it, like, early on.
Yeah, fair. But I just think this is quite a limp signing from them generally. He's a really small sample size for how long he's been in the Premier League. He's got under 1,600 minutes, or around 1,600 minutes. 17 starts from the Premier League across his entire Liverpool career. And, like, remember, this is Leverkusen's record signing ever. Like, he shows decent aerial, like, win percentage, safe passing, but, like, limited proof of, like, repeatability as a, like, starter volume. Okay. His progressive metrics look fairly systemated, than more so than, like, individually elite progressive metrics. Like, there's no creation, there's no ball carrying, there's no big switches or long balls, all short passes that keep possession. And I think that's kind of easy in a dominant Liverpool team. And I think that would also have been useful in Alonso Leverkusen that had, like, Xhaka at the bottom of a double pivot. I think that works really nicely. But The Leverkusen band has been broken up, and Leverkusen possession's already down 10% in last season. It's down 13% in their title-winning season. Like, the crutches that they once had of this high possession, short passing system, a lot of them have kind of been kicked away. And I think a lot of players' individual talents are going to be a lot more exposed and a lot more relied on in terms of on-ball ability. And I think Quance's, he is young, so he could develop with this, but I think his on-ball ability is much more of a, relies on a very, very good system than he is just an individually good player on the ball. Never loved him. I think he has a much lower ceiling than a lot of people think, and that a lot of people thought 2 years ago. I don't really think this is a huge needle mover for a team that, you know, won the Bundesliga 2 years ago and seemed to be kind of regressing quite a lot. Obviously, it's hard to stay as good as you were when you lose your manager, when you lose your best player that has been there since youth academy, when you lose your metronomic midfielder, when you lose all of these parts that made you so good. I just think that if they wanted to stay competitive, like Champions League-wise, they needed to make something a little bit punchier in terms of a move than this.
I think this was a punchy move. Like, I think he's a good player. Like, I don't know. I really like Quansah. I like him a lot. I think the bigger issue is that, like, they presumably planned their summer assuming that Erik ten Hag was going to be their coach. And then they sure. were like, actually, this guy sucks and everyone fucking yeah. hates him. And now you wonder, like, what are all these players like doing? Like, they went and got Ben Seguir, who I like. They went and got Quansah, who I like. But I think, well, are these players fitted to what they end up doing next? Like, I don't know. Sure. Okay. Goalkeeper, Donnarumma.
Oh, I thought you might go for that.
Makes no sense. Stupid move. Don't get it. Like, I and the way I'm seeing him talked about in the British media is insane. Like, they're literally talking about him. They're like, he's going to be so useful for them on set pieces. His ability to claim high balls. What are you talking about? He sucks at high balls. Did you see him in the Champions League last season? Anytime there's a, like, sometimes, okay, a corner is dropped right on top of him and he's able to punch it away. But his main technique for dealing with, like, high balls into the box on set pieces is to go to ground. He falls over and pretends he's been fouled. That he does it all the time. Like, that is honestly, like, his preferred method of dealing with it. Is he a good shot stopper? Well, he was terrible. Shot stopper, one of the worst in Ligue 1 last season. He was the best in Ligue 1 the season before. I think generally he's very good, but he's not so good that, like, he's never bad. Like, sometimes he's bad. And he's not good with his feet. Like, not only not good, but he's worse at claiming high balls and worse with his feet than James Trafford is. Like, James Trafford actually has some interesting long balls in his locker. Donnarumma doesn't. Donnarumma, I think, is, like, notably awful with the ball at his feet. Whereas Trafford, I think, is just, like, not particularly great. But Trafford has sure. also got a knockdown fee and will always be easy to resell because he's a homegrown goalkeeper.
And he's young.
It's like it's impossible to lose money on a homegrown goalkeeper, honestly. Like you will, if you keep him in your squad forever, then you've got a homegrown player in your squad, like it's fine. But they went and got Donnarumma, who's not even a different kind of goalkeeper. Like he just, I don't think he does anything they need him to do. Like except occasionally save some shots. But Trafford could have done that. I just think it's a really, really strange use of resources. They could have just simply kept Ederson. They only got like 12 million euros for Ederson. Why sell him?
Yeah, yeah.
They swapped Ederson and 13 million like for Donnarumma. Like what was the value of that?
Keeping Ederson and bringing back Trafford makes the most sense because you then have two different profiles and you can build in Trafford and transition to a slightly different type of football throughout a season, not just like, okay, now we are completely different to what we have been for the last 6 years.
Yeah. I the whole thing I find absolutely baffling. I think it's a really stupid, weird move. I do think it will hurt them over the course of the season. I think it will hurt them quite a lot. Yeah, and again, like people talking about him right now, it's just like, go and try and watch the way he dealt with set pieces last season at PSG and tell me that this is a guy who's really, really confident claiming high balls. Is he fuck? Don't like it. Stupid. What have you got next? Man, we need to accelerate. Okay. So we've got four guys left.
I'm going to go for like Cam, 10.
Okay.
Mateus, can you? I've said it before. Okay. Said it again. Don't like it. Too much money. Too old. Even if he does make United better for the next three seasons, United will be, as a long-term goal, it's too short. It's too much of a big outlay for a short-sighted gain. United won't be good for a minimum five seasons. He's going to be too old by the time United are good. Same with Mbeumo. He's turning 27 this season, so he'll be aged out way before United are like an elite team ever again, if they are.
Mm.
And the cost of him and Mbeumo could have like easily covered like Baleba or Xavi Simons plus a centre-back. There's way smarter ways United could have invested that money into the squad. Baleba's a different thing in that he would. Brighton never wanted to sell him and the money got like kind of ridiculous, all of that, that's fine. But the amount of money that was spent for players that aren't going to, they'll move the needle in the immediate future, but they will not be there in the like what they're aiming as a long-term goal. And also it was just a massive overperformer last season. The only player who overperformed more than him in terms of expected goals was Brian Mbeumo, and now they're in the same team, which is fantastic. Unsustainable streaky finishing. He's got a high share of low-value shots. His career shots and target percentage and like goals to shots sit like mid-table for elite 10s and second strikers type profiles. He has a pretty low creation ceiling. Well, it's okay. But like his expected assists per 90 and shot creating actions per 90 are decent, but like not breaking into the top 25% among Europe's top five attacking midfield creators. The fee that you pay for him, he needs to be in that if he's going to be sitting as like, obviously, he's not playing as a Cam in the United system, but they are kind of like Juliet/Juliet 10s. You want more creation from him. You want more reliable finishing from him. You want his underlying numbers to be a lot closer to what they are on the like actual tangible goal numbers and what they were last season. You certainly want that if you're playing him beside a guy who is also really streaky, overperforming, and isn't a huge creative output. And yeah, I just think mid-tier non-penalty expected goals per 90 and expected assists per 90 for a player playing in that second striker 10 role, lots of low value shots, the price implies like out and out star, and I think he is a very good player that United spent too much on and he is too old.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Like, I think he's a good player. I think he will be quite good for United. I also just think it was like a really strange use of resources and
fully agree.
Like, I wouldn't do it. Like that's basically the long and short of it.
Yeah.
Like, I just think this was something they could have done something much more valuable with. So like, yeah, it's not like we think he'll be terrible. In fact, I think he'd have been quite helpful for them against City, but like,
I think he'll be pretty good on the pitch. I think he'll make United better, but it's
he'll be one of your better players. Yeah, like all these guys you signed, like Mbeumo is one of your better players, but having
doesn't mean it's a good signing.
No, especially because like, oh my God, the shooting tendencies of all these guys.
Oh, really low percentage. Really low percentage.
Are insane. Like, they are insane. I was watching Mbeumo in the City game, and I was just like, this guy's got no brain. His brain's fallen out. Like, he scored so many screamers last season.
This is my issue.
That now he's gone wrong. Like, and he's just like, I'm gonna score. I'm gonna score from 20 yards.
I said this when they were both signed. I was like, they're both coming from smaller teams as the big dog. Like, they were that guy who was like, jump on my back, guys. I'm going to carry this team. I'm going to score.
And off seasons where everything went in.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Their egos are absolutely fucking roided.
And now they're doing it at Old Trafford, being like, guys, jump on my back. The Mbeumo train's about to leave. And then it just doesn't. It just breaks down before it exits the station. And you're like, okay, right. This is a problem. Because you're hellbent on being like, I'm going to get the ball. Every single time I get the ball, I'm scoring a screamer.
Yeah.
Doesn't work like that. It just doesn't.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do the last midfield slot. And I'm putting in Mateus Fernandes.
Mm.
So, he's gone to West Ham for £38 million. West Ham did need some midfield reinforcements. They had to loan out Alvarez because he hated it so much, he wanted to leave. They brought in Sungutu Magasa, who I actually really like. Right, but he is a kid from Monaco. He's played centre-back. He's played DM. He's a pretty big physical presence. He wins the ball a lot. That's definitely a player they needed. But he's also, like I said, a child. And then they went and got Fernandes for like big money. Like that is big money. 38 mil plus add-ons. And I don't quite understand why. Like, okay, a lot of people rate Fernandes. And it's not that I don't. I do think there's talent there. You know, he was obviously playing for Southampton like last season. No one was really going to look good at Southampton, but he didn't look good. Like the one number that looked decent for him is like he had an okay number of dribbles. I think he was at like 45% dribble success and he had like 1.5 dribbles a game, which in a kind of central midfield role, like that is pretty good. However, that's it. Nothing in the passing popped, certainly not shots. He defended, you know, like in the way that everyone has to when their team like is constantly under the cosh. But again, he's not a plus defender. And fundamentally, I look at him and I'm like, you don't produce expected goals and assists. And you also don't do the like great, you know, deep passing and defending that a normal central midfielder does. So what he really is this guy who's between a central midfielder and an attacking midfielder. Not attacking enough to be an attacking midfielder. Not defensive enough to be a central midfielder. Why do West Ham need that guy? West Ham just need like solid central midfielders who can do the things central midfielders do. They don't need fucking galaxy brain midfield signings. And they've already got this guy who's not quite an AM and not quite a CM. He's called Lucas Paqueta. If you want a guy who's a bit of a weird fit, you do not need to go and spend £38 million on that guy. And again, this goes back to my Wolves point, which is you are misdiagnosing how much time you have to get shit right. Like sure. You are assuming that, oh, it's okay that we've bought this project DM and this project AM because, you know,
the project's going to be the championship.
Exactly. The project's going to be the championship. We're not going to get relegated. Okay. If you want to build a squad for the championship, they've actually done kind of a decent job. I think these players will be good for them in the championship. But are they going to keep them up in the Premier League? Like Magasa might, but I just look at it and I think if they'd gone and got a 40 million, like solid central midfielder who can really defend and pass a bit, I would be so much more confident about them. But they've swapped over the fullbacks in the course of a summer. They've got incredibly slow players through the spine. The other day, they started Fernandes and James Ward-Prowse as their central midfield pairing. And I was like, yeah, I don't think that's going to work. And lo and behold, it did not work. Like, so I don't really understand them at all. Like, it's just really strange, like, kind of Hail Mary signing. I don't get it in the slightest. Just when you are a shitty, potentially relegated team, just sign guys who you know can do the stuff that matters to you. And the stuff that matters to you is like they should be able to cover ground, they should be able to defend, and they should be reasonable passers. Because the other part of it is that Graham Potter is probably not going to be there for long. And that's not even... I'm not even saying that about like form. I mean, when you are that kind of team, you tend to change manager quite a bit. And so you want to get players who can play stable roles under multiple coaches, right? If you go and get a defensive midfielder who's big, fast, strong, and puts up loads and loads of defensive actions and can pass a bit, there is not a manager in the world who's like, I've got no use for this guy. Even if they just have him in the squad, everybody is like, okay, this is a useful player to have. Like, it's not going to kill us. But this weird hybrid player, No, thank you. Miss me with that. So I just think this is a crazy move for a team like them. Like if Brighton, I mean, Brighton didn't need to do this, but if Brighton or someone had done this, then I'd be like, sure, Brighton can take that kind of risk. Or Newcastle. Newcastle can take that kind of risk. But West Ham this season? No. Like no risks. No risk from you, please. Who have you got?
Okay, so we've got a centre back and a left back left.
Yeah.
So I'm going to slightly cheat here because this is like a shoehorn centre back. But he okay. has played there this season already. But he is traditionally right back. I'm going to go with Kyle Walker.
Wow.
To Burnley.
That's
via
a good one.
City via Milan, I guess.
Extremely cooked. Extremely cooked.
They paid £5 million for him. He is 35 years old. He's their top earner, £75,000 a week. And I don't mind, like you say, he is fairly cooked. I don't mind promoted teams bringing in some kind of like proven veteran tone setters, kind of just to try and desperately stay in Premier League. But I feel if you do that, they have to be relatively cheap and you can't rely on them to be like, you're one of our like big minutes guys. It's kind of like you're more of a tone setter in the dressing room and younger kids can learn off you, but we're not like fully reliant on you and you're also not costing us an arm and a leg. Kyle Walker is not. He is their highest paid player. He's played every minute in Premier League so far. And while he was a great Premier League right back at one stage, or potentially there's an argument there that he's the best ever Premier League era right back.
Sure, definitely.
But physicality was his game, particularly speed. His pace hid a multitude of sins. So he was a good defender still, but because he was so fast, he got away with so much more than most other defenders. Now that he's aged into his mid-30s, he's basically just become a average defender for a low block team that isn't overly pacey anymore. And the team's going to play pretty unattractive football and probably get relegated. I just don't see what benefit they have from this for spending so much money and relying so much on a player that is definitely cooked. If they're going to go down, try something a little bit more forward thinking, I guess. Or if you're going to get in a veteran, get in a cheaper one that you don't. He's played 450 minutes already in the four or five games so far this season. So he's 200 minutes less than he played for his entire stint at Milan already. He's 35 years old. He's cooked. They're spending way too much money on his wages. And he's been asked to do way more defending as well. Like he's at 4.5 tackles and interceptions per 90 so far this season. He averaged 1.5 during his time at City and 2 at Milan. This is a guy who is being asked to do way more defending than he's ever done before, which has never been his strongest attribute. If you think about what historically has made Kyle Walker great, those are the things he's actually not being asked to do anymore. His progressive carries are down by about 30% on what they were at City. Carries into the final third down even more than that. Like he's just an older, slower version of himself, being asked to do way more of the things that weren't what made him great. And he's paying a ton of minutes and costing a load of money. It just seems a bit short-sighted and desperate for me.
Yeah, I don't really understand this. Like, this seems like a pure, we need some Premier League experience, boys, like arse move. And I just think, like, okay, well, Sunderland, again, not to harp on about Sunderland, but Sunderland wouldn't have got Granit Xhaka to do that, who's definitely still useful.
Yeah.
Even Brentford were like, okay, we'll get Henderson to do that. Like, that's good stuff. Yeah. I agree with this one. I'm going to wrap us up with a Burnley guy, too. Like Burnley were kind of keyed into like a bunch of signings, obviously, you know, like so they were gonna make Bashir Humphreys permanent after coming up and did, but then they also went and got Quilinchi Hartman, who I just don't really like at all. Like he came to them, like he's 23, I guess, so like it's not like he can never be anything else, but he came to them from Feyenoord, and in the Netherlands he was extremely weak defensively.
Yeah.
Again, like Wolfer, like the Eredivisie is not a tough league. Like, if you look bad defensively in the Eredivisie, something is going on. Like, to the point that when I see a defender's numbers in the Eredivisie and they're just very good, I'm like, this is a red flag. Like, I want your defensive numbers in the Eredivisie to look like you were playing five-year-olds. Like, that, because if you're going to have the physicality to go to the top level, you kind of need to look that dominant in the Eredivisie. And he just looked actually quite bad defensively in the Eredivisie. And he's an okay enough passer. He's very similar to Bashir Humphreys. But Bashir Humphreys was pretty good for them in the Championship. And I think the Championship is a much better representation of how you're going to be in the Premier League than the Eredivisie.
Oh, for sure.
Championship is a good league. And actually,
tough league as well.
And players have transferred
from
the Championship to the Premier League pretty successfully in the last couple of years. So I just think that it was a strange thing to do. And basically, they bought like three right backs this summer. Like, one was Walker, one was Quillenshi Hartman, and one was Bashir Humphreys. Like, and I wouldn't have done like two of those guys. So yeah, not a fan. So that gives us our 11. We've got Donnarumma, Chachua, Kwanzaa, Walker, Hartman. Midfield is Partey, Mateus Fernandes, Mateus Cunha, and the attack is Alanga, Gyökeres, and Jadon Sancho. Let's move on to the burn book. All right, it's time for the burn book. Pete, I'm going to take something out of burn book.
Okay.
Have you seen The Gilded Age?
Is it a time period, or is it a show?
It's a show.
I've not seen it. No.
Yeah, it's a show. It was created by Julian Fellowes, the creator and writer of Downton Abbey, and it is set in the Gilded Age. You know, so obviously like the late 19th century in New York.
Yeah.
Among like upper crust, and it's basically exactly the same as Downton Abbey. It's like, here are all these fucking toffs. Obviously they're not toffs because they're Americans.
Yeah.
But here are all these rich fucks, and here are their like, you know, piss poor like mud servants, you know, who like sleep in shit under the stairs. And this show, is it good? No. But is it good fun? Also no. But is it good to like zone out to and let it just like wash over you? Like, yeah, it's really oh my god, like basically it's incredibly expensive looking. The actors are all good. Like, it's got an amazing cast. Like, a really amazing cast. And the costumes are great. Everything looks really, really good. The plot doesn't matter. The dialogue is stupid. And you don't really need to pay that much attention. The drama is always, we're rich, what if we stop being rich? Or we're rich, and so therefore we need to shun this person because, like, they're seen as an outsider in our society. But then also, like, Julian Fellowes doesn't quite want to commit to it. So every now and then there'll be, like, someone who's a racist, but they can't be really racist in an unpleasant way. It's like, because he doesn't want his show to like make you feel bad. So there's an episode where they like go to the South, that like two black journalists go to like, you know, Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee school or whatever. And some like fucking racist like white guys turn up. And these racist white guys behave in such a way as to make clear that they are racist, but they don't say anything that's that racist or do anything that's that racist. Like, or rather, they do things that are racist. But, you know, like, there's no real threat that something terrible is going to happen.
Yeah, because the stabilizers are on with the racism.
Yes, exactly. So they don't have the balls to, like, follow through on any of this shit. And, of course, as well, the rich people in the show, it's like the bad ones are racists, but the good ones, the ones where men are like, are not racist. Even though obviously they definitely would have been racist as fuck at the time.
Sure.
So like the show is like taking place in complete fucking fantasy land. But Emma and I watched a few episodes whenever it came out, like whenever the first series came out a couple of years ago. Then we just like didn't watch it for years. And another couple of series like came out in that time. And then recently we were kind of like, right, we need something to watch. Let's go back to this. And honestly, after two episodes, I was like, I'm having so much fun. There is a whole season that is devoted to like, some people are starting a new opera house in New York, and they're like, will this take the place of the old opera house? And as Brian Phillips wrote in an article, he was like, there's no tension to this because one of these opera houses is called the Met and you've heard of it. And the other opera house you've never heard of in your fucking life. So it's like that's basically the level of drama we're operating on.
For an entire season. That's 33% of the season.
That's literally like the whole drama of that season. Like, it's the dumbest shit on earth. But yeah, anyway, I love it and I recommend it. And
it's really highly, it's got 8.1 on IMDb and 89% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, it's like a 3 out of 10, like for actual quality. But for watchability, it is like an 8. Like, sure. I really enjoy watching it, and when it was over I genuinely felt sad. But I don't care about any of the characters. I don't give a shit about anything that's going on. And if you ask me, is it good, I would be like, I really think the costume designers did a great job. And that's like the extent of it. Anyway,
that was taken out.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, I enjoy it. I'd recommend it, especially if you're looking for something like dumb to watch with your partner, where you're like, you know, you pick up your phone during the ad break And then when it comes back from the ad break, you're maybe still very slightly on your phone. It's fine. Doesn't matter. Mm. Nothing happens. What happened in this scene? Somebody was just like, I can't believe they're starting a rival opera house. That bitch. Like, that's kind of it. But obviously, no one says bitch. They're just like, oh, this is jolly awful. Like, anyway, it's a very stupid show, but I recommend it. It's the same way that Downton Abbey, you know, like Downton Abbey is actually more challenging than this show, which is funny. But Downton Abbey is like a similar, like, dumb good time, in my opinion. But the only problem is Downton Abbey then sends people off to war and it's like everyone's got shell shock and shit. And you're like, that's a bit of a fucking downer. Mm. And also Downton Abbey kills people. Whereas this show doesn't even have the balls to do that. Like, it constantly threatens to kill characters. And then it's like, oh no, she didn't die. Actually, she fell in love with the doctor who came to cure her. Like, it's so stupid. It's like a soap opera. Anyway, fair enough. Right. What are you taking out of the burn book?
Okay. What am I taking out of the burn book? What I'm going to take out of the burn book this week is pilot assist.
What the fuck's that?
This is a car thing. So I think it's still palatable and a reasonable removal. Because basically what it is like, it's basically autopilot on your car, which is class. So we got a new car just after Bonnie was born. It was new to me, 6-year-old. But it's like the first like proper adult car that I've bought in my, like, I'm in my mid-30s. All my other cars were, you know...
The first adult car that you've totaled.
That was Jess. And we got it fixed 11,000 pounds later.
Whoa! Oh my God.
That was just the... Obviously, this is covered by the insurance. That is
Peter,
just...
That is horrible.
That was just our car. So we still have the other car and the personal injury claim that is also being filed against.
Mm-hmm.
So those premiums are going up. But yeah, so it's the first like adult car I bought, and like the other cars were like your kind of hatchbacks you had in your 20s, and then we shared a car with Jess's dad for a while, so like that was never my car, that was always his car. But now we have an adult car. It's a real like DILF-mobile. But it has this function on it, which is called pilot assist, which is basically cruise control, adaptive cruise control, so it basically sets your speed based on the car in front, but it also steers the car for you. My understanding of it was that it was used for use in like slow moving traffic, because when you put it on, it defaults the speed to 20 miles an hour. Okay. So I was like, okay, so it's limited to 20 miles an hour. That kind of makes sense. Basically, when you get stuck in traffic, you can just turn it on and kind of sit and just, it moves your own car through the slow moving traffic until you can drive again. That's a really good thing. I sat with that for like we've had the car for like 6 months. And then a couple of weeks ago, I was like, the function itself is the same as cruise control. So like, what if I just try and turn it on at like 70 miles an hour? Like, surely that'll work. And then it made me think, like, obviously
high stakes move.
Obviously this is made for like motorway stuff. So, and it totally is. I don't know why it defaults to 20 miles an hour. But I was driving back from Sheffield and I was like, yeah, I'm going to stick it on. I was driving back on my own as well because Bonnie was like, she wasn't insufferable. She just had a bad weekend. She didn't sleep much at all. So okay. I sent her and Jess back in the train. And I drove home from Sheffield.
That's a good move for everyone, I think. Like, the train with a baby is basically fine.
Oh my God, it's completely fine. Like, they're just out and about.
You can get up, walk around. Like, yeah, exactly. It's normal.
Our journey would have been like 6 hours with her in the back. I did it in like just under 4 because I didn't stop. And the reason I didn't stop, Patrick, was because once I got in the motorway, set the adaptive cruise control, or set the pilot assist 70 miles an hour.
Took a nap.
Car and a half length in front of me was the... like the distance that it was keeping. And if there was no car there, then it would just default to 70 miles an hour. Pilot assist, like you're watching the steering wheel move on its own accord. And it's really
scary.
It's unsettling at the start.
Yeah.
But all you need to do is you need to keep your hand on the wheel. So it needs to feel, the wheel needs to feel some pressure of your hand.
So it's like a nervous woman. Well, you've just got. She needs the steadying hand of the DILF in the DILF mobile.
Well, it's more of a safety feature so that you don't have a nap, basically, and that you stay attentive. But
every now and then it should just spin the wheel at randomly. You know, where it, like the wheel should just start spinning around like the kid in The Exorcist's fucking head, and you should have to like grab it.
But apparently, you can stick a water bottle in one of the like gaps, and that's adequate weight. So I didn't have a water bottle to try this, but. I'm told you can stick a water bottle in it that then it adds enough weight that it thinks you're holding it, so it literally just drives on its own. This car is speeding up, slowing down, turning around. Like, obviously, these are gradual corners because you're in a motorway. I haven't tried it, and I don't think it's really designed, or it's not as sophisticated technology for, like, pure autonomous driving, specifically urban driving. This is, like, motorway driving.
Yeah.
But, like, it took the monotony out of it so much. Like, I did 4 hours without a break. 85% of that was on the motorway. Basically, I just said it when we left Sheffield, when I left Sheffield, got on the motorway, and I didn't turn it off until I got to the bottom of the M25 coming north up through London again. And it was basically drove itself home. And I was like, this is like, I'm literally doing nothing. I'm just holding the wheel. And just everything's going
I could have smoothly. Done it.
Yeah, literally. Like, the car is doing
this is
it
the
itself.
Thing, right? This is the thing. Every passing year, it gets easier to learn to drive, right? Like, because then there'll come a point where it's just like, all you got to do to learn to drive is you'll just be like, don't drive into anyone, you know, whatever. No, and your car will be like, yeah, okay.
Like, driverless taxis exist in the world already. They're out in society. This technology's here. And
but it's a virgin move, isn't it? It's like, it's a bit like having an Android. It's like, it's an ick.
But what it made me think about as well, just on your comment there, was the drivers that are going to learn to drive in 10 years are going to be vastly less skilled than the drivers that learned, like, when I learned and when my parents learned.
You're goddamn right, they
are. Because, like, say when my parents learned, their cars would have had, like, external chokes and they wouldn't have had power steering. But the fundamental skill set needed to drive kind of was the same to them than when I drove. Fully manual cars. You didn't have a choke and you had power steering, and like the wheels turned when you actually turned the wheel. That was great. They were helpful, but they weren't transformative or changed the way that people learned. You still had to learn how to do a hill start. You still had to learn how to find the biting point so that you didn't roll back down the hill. You know, 15 years ago that changed, or 10 years ago that changed, because all cars have hill start now. You know, when you take your foot off the brake, the car actually holds itself on a hill because it senses it's on the hill. So it's like, I'm not going to let you roll back even if you haven't found your biting point. So immediately your need for skill is less. And then adding in this stuff getting basically the curve being exponential with how this technology takes over just the automotive industry. Yeah. People are literally going to have to do nothing. They're just going to sit in the car, press a button, and then it goes.
Even like parallel parking, you know, like there was a time obviously when you just literally looked over your shoulder and did it. And now it's like, you get a fucking aerial like grid that shows you.
Well, there's cars that do it itself now. There's cars that they scan the parking spot as you drive past it. As you stop, then you hit a button and it just drives itself into the spot. And like, in one way, I'm all for it because I think this is like, there's a lot of monotony about driving. And also the roads would be way safer if everybody's car was automated.
Yeah.
Because then you would remove human error.
And they talk to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the way that they're doing this with like, you know, like freight shipping.
Sure.
So the idea is it all just fucking talks to each other. And like that way, none of it should crash because it's all working on the same system, which is like operating everything.
It's the same as like the adaptive cruise control. I set the distance from the car in front of me that this car needs to maintain. And it uses technology and sensors to maintain that.
Yeah.
Versus a human switching off for 30 seconds because like their baby's crying
stupid
in the back.
Fucking baby's crying, yeah.
And then they plow into the back of someone. Like, I'm all for the advancement of technology and it alleviating the need to physically drive for like long periods of time. It's a nice amenity to have in your car.
Sure. Okay. What am I putting in the burn book? Oh, immaturity. Behaving like a child. So I think that among men in our society, they all just fucking act like children in every regard. I mean, like, and I think you can see this in pretty much every area. And I do think your attitude should be try and be mature, try and behave like a grown up. So I see versions of this on like football Twitter, for example. I opened Twitter today and I saw some Chelsea fan who'd put on a suit and gone to the Ballon d'Or just to stand and like shout like, champions of Europe, you'll never sing that at Victor Gyökeres. Like, and Victor Gyökeres was just looking at him like, what the fuck are you doing? like you're a grown-up. Like, what's going on? But in football, you see it a lot. You know, like, people doing the wanker sign at someone who's taking a corner. You're like, unless that person's actually a wanker, like why? You're a grown man. But I do think that there are much worse examples of this that we kind of see everywhere. So, you know, there's this whole thing about like men going out to dinner with their partners and you see the partner and she's like, she's done her makeup, she's done her hair,
yeah.
She's wearing a nice dress.
We spoke about this before.
She's all dolled up and then The guy is just wearing like fucking disgusting long shorts. He looks like shit and he doesn't care about it. Or he's wearing a tracksuit and I just do not understand this shit at all. Similarly, dancing like a twat on social media. I don't mean like dancing. Oh, like maybe you love to dance like, and TikToks. You don't care. I'm okay with that. But yeah, that kind of stuff. Like, do you remember? I was thinking about this. I thought, you know what? I was so glad I didn't have children when flossing was a thing. Do you remember that bullshit?
Yeah.
Like, because there were so many adults who were doing it with their children and putting it up online and thinking it was so funny. Guys who shout, "Wee!" when someone drops something in a restaurant. Cunts.
Yeah. Like,
just all this kind of shit. I'm just like, do you have no self-respect at all? Have you considered just acting like an adult for a bit? Like, I'm not saying you have to be boring, but all this shit, I just find it embarrassing. Like, that's the thing with half of the football Twitter stuff. I think that quite often I get in these conversations with people on Twitter where they think they're like, "You're rattled, mate. You're rattled." And I'm like, I honestly just find it embarrassing that I'm talking to you and you're behaving this way.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just find it embarrassing to talk to somebody who is such an infant. Like,
these people kind of seem like it seems like it's like Groundhog Day, except they're a character in the Inbetweeners.
Yes. And similarly, I think when you go to a restaurant, restaurants should have dress codes.
Oh, this is interesting, actually. So I agree with this because we went to a Michelin star restaurant on Friday for lunch, Kitchen W in Kensington. It was a voucher for our wedding. It was lunch and it was sunny. Mm. I wore shorts and they didn't have a dress code, but I walked in and I was like, oh shit,
What shoes were you wearing?
Adidas Gazelles.
Mm.
Okay. I was wearing a shirt though.
You're pretty near the edge though. There,
but the thing is, I because it was lunch and like
I do think it's different at lunch. I think it's different depending on what Jess was wearing.
But yeah, I mean, it was fine with what Jess was wearing. But it was something that it was like a blind spot for me that I just for whatever reason didn't consider. And as soon as I walked in, I was like, oh shit, I'm wearing shorts, and like it was fine. But the fact that I was aware of that is different.
And I do think a warm day lunch, it is different. Yeah. I think evening, certainly. Yeah. It's not even like I'm saying like no trainers or anything. Like, I just think
were like linen plated shorts as well. Sports shorts.
But I'm like, it should just look like you've made an effort. Like, that. I think restaurants should have rules for this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a good thing. Make people feel like they actually need to make an effort to go to a restaurant. Like, it's... Like, when clubs have a dress code, that's stupid. That doesn't exist anymore. But, like, when we were, like...
Jeans and shoes.
But when we were 18, right, that was jeans the thing. Where they'd be like, no trainers, mate. And you're just like, it's a club, and my shoes are going to get ruined.
I'm having to wear brown brogues with bit-cut jeans. That's the fashion you want in here.
Yeah, you're like, we've all got to dress like Jeremy Clarkson. Yeah. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah,
going out shirts.
Yeah. So there's...
But people did dress up.
Well, they all look like shit, but technically they were smartly dressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, the club is a stupid place for that to be the rule. Like, it doesn't make sense. It's dark, it's dirty, it doesn't matter. But a restaurant, there are people there who are celebrating special occasions. And if your partner's dressed up, you should dress up. Like, that is my rule. Like, I just think, don't turn up to the club, the restaurant, wearing your disgusting, like, little polo. Your disgusting polo, your shit tight jorts and your fucking trainers and expect not to get turned away. You should be turned away. Like, we as a society, we should have decorum. Like, we should bring back decorum. So that's my opinion. But I just see this everywhere. Like, I constantly run into just grown men who are acting like infants.
Mm-hmm.
And half the time, you know, like these guys who fucking honk at everybody like when they drive as well, I'm just like, you sound like a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, we're not triggered by it. We just find it embarrassing. Like, so I just think everyone needs to fucking pattern up. What have you got?
I can be quick because we've gone long on this podcast. What I'm putting in the burn book are the pre-holiday wardrobe. We are going to Seville.
I think I know what you mean.
Next week. We're going to Seville this week.
Second person who's told me that today.
We'll fly to Seville on the day that this podcast released. So to the people listening to this, I will be in Seville, hopefully at Bar Alfalfa, eating chicharrones.
Oh, God.
But when you have a holiday coming up, it makes compiling your own wardrobe for that week before the holiday, very, very difficult, because even like I'm trying to get ahead on packing, even more so with the podcast week and the baby. But that means like I've had to earmark and set aside a load of clothes, like a load of top tier clothes, Premier League clothes, that I'm like, I cannot touch them because those are going in the suitcase to go to Seville with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also want a little bit of options. You're not going to bring everything, but you're like, okay, I haven't figured out exactly what I want to bring to Seville. I haven't fully checked the weather yet. We haven't figured out what we might do certain nights. Do I need, like you say, a fancier outfit? I mean, unlikely considering we have a 7-month-old baby, but these are considerations that you need to make, which means that you then set aside even more clothes than you need, taking them out of the roster because you know you can't use them in that week because they won't be washed, laundered, dried, folded, assimilated into your rotation again in time. And you set all those stuff aside, and that's kind of fine if you never leave the house that week. But then an office day comes around and you're like, you look at your wardrobe and it feels like when you open the fridge and there's like half an onion, some chocolate mousse, and like, I don't know, half a tin of sardines in there, and you're like, what the fuck am I going to make out of this? Right? Even though these are all clothes that I once wore regularly, they've slipped down the tiers, they've slipped to B list or C list.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, they've become so alien to me now, and I'm looking at them and I'm being like, what would I pair up with that? Like, what am I going to wear that with? What do I have in stock in bottoms that would go with that top and that I can make like look seemingly put together as an outfit? And it's just this weird limbo stage of like, all of those clothes, they're not retired, but they're kind of like pseudo-retired. Like, they're there, but you haven't chucked them out, but they rarely see out of the house anymore, even if they see inside the house. And it just feels like you're wearing somebody else's clothes. I wore a hoodie. This hoodie, actually. I wore a hoodie to work on Tuesday. And this isn't like a question of professionalism. I work in a creative industry that arguably could do with a much higher dress code. Arguably, they're too lax with dress code. People have their toes out in the office in summer.
Not sure that's permissible.
Complete red flag. Complete red flag. Straight to jail. But wearing a hoodie out to the office, I just don't really wear hoodies. They're kind of like at-home clothes there, pop-to-the-shop clothes there, gym, or we're going on a walk, or I'm just a bit cold clothes, I'm going to pop on a hoodie. I'm not like, a hoodie is never really like a part of my outfit. Wore, and to be fair, I did put a Universal Works black wool vest over it.
Okay, so like I don't know, you've zhuzhed it up a bit.
I've zhuzhed it up a bit, but it still felt like a Sunday afternoon fit down at the pub or the wine deli versus Tuesday afternoon in the office. But my point was more that like, it was just such a weird dynamic, or such a weird like process to figure out all of these clothes that I've bought and worn dozens of times. How the fuck do I wear this again? It feels so raw. It feels so like strange to pair all these clothes together because you've taken all the clothes that you're so used to, your like current rotation of clothes, and set them all aside in this little like impenetrable little fake box that is just earmarked for holiday clothes, and you cannot touch them. It's like it's a Christmas Day food when the fridge is packed and you stare at it and you're like, I'm so hungry. And your mom's like, do not fucking touch a thing, because it's all for Christmas Day. And you're like, well, what the fuck am I going to eat? And she's like, I don't care, starve. That's what I feel like with my clothes at the minute, because I'm going to the office tomorrow and I'm going to have this whole ordeal again. And it stressed me out, Patrick. It stressed me out.
I think you can wear any old shit to work, though. Who cares?
Yeah, well,
it's the least important situation.
That's
yeah,
the thing.
I guess so.
I care.
I do know what you mean. It's the same way that like, you know, I guess you're getting used to this now. Like, but you know, like when you start weaning your child, and you're just like, you know, maybe you go for a run or something, and then you're like, right, okay, now I'm going to put my clothes on. And then I just look at the stuff I want to wear. And then I look at and then I think, but this is about to be covered in broccoli.
Sure.
And so you just end up wearing the same like four things again and again, even though they fucking depress you. But you're like, well, it's in service of the greater good. But then over time, you kind of get into the habit of like being very risk averse with your clothes, and you need to start like actually wearing them again. It's a very complicated situation.
Yeah.
At least I find it complicated. Okay, that brings us to a close for our public episode of the podcast. If you'd like extra episodes, please do subscribe at patreon.com/patrickvs. We've got extra episodes, two extra episodes a month. People seem to be very happy with them. You could also buy them individually if there's one that particularly takes your fancy. So you can consider doing that, and then that will give you a taste. You can decide whether you want to subscribe to us permanently. Thank you to all of you who sent us questions. Thank you to those of you who do subscribe, and we'll catch you later. Bye.